Welcome to Signs of the Times, a look at recent world events from around our kitchen table. It's the end of August, and the last time we felt like this and the world was in this shape, it was several weeks before the events of September 11, 2001. George Bush was at his Texas ranch, specially purchased as a prop for his new presidency.
The American people were running after his limousine and chucking things at it.
And Bush's popularity was almost as bad as it is today.
Which makes you wonder, what do they have in store for us now? Looking back at August 2001, it almost looks as if Bush was shunted out of Washington because there was important business to be taken care of by the people who really pull the strings of power. And he was sent off to have a little R&R at his ranch.
Lots of naps.
Lots of naps. Lots of bicycles.
Driving his giant pickup around.
So we look at what's going on, and there are eerie similarities to recent weeks with what happened prior to 9/11. And
indeed, Bush's popularity and his low ratings and the lull in activity at the time, just to make the point clear, seemed to have necessitated something to push his ratings back up. That something at the time obviously was 9/11, after which his popularity did spike again according to the polls.
We ran a graphic a couple of days ago on the Signs page that illustrated that beautifully, where you saw, you know, neatly graphed out his poll results, and then you saw the, you know, which were down around 40%, below 40% approval, that then shot way up to over 80%, close to 90% after the events of 9/11, when he did his remarkable transformation from frat boy idiot to commander-in-chief.
Indeed, it seems that this president has a very hard time maintaining the popularity, or maintaining his popularity among the U.S. population. After 9/11, or at 9/11, his popularity soared in the polls. Then there was a steady decline to just before the Iraq War, when, you know, so he decided that he needed to have the policymakers in the U.S. decided that they needed to have a war to boost his ratings again, and indeed the ratings shot up just at the time that the war was announced. Then after the war started, his popularity started to slump again until the election in 2004, when you had this debate, this massive debate in the news over who was the best president, or who was the best choice to be president, and that helped to push his ratings back up again. And then since then, they have headed south again in a pretty drastic way until, as we're saying, until today, when there's a serious lull. Not much seems to be happening, but that's just on the surface, we suspect. And his ratings really are, by all accounts, I think 36% of the U.S. population actually approves of him as their president. We have to wonder what they're going to do this time to push his ratings back up again.
And of course, we look at the polls and Bush's popularity, and obviously when all these events have transpired, they've pushed his ratings sky high. But certainly we don't think that the only reason that all this has transpired is only to push up his ratings. And in fact, it's the decline shown in the chart that we had on the Science page recently is especially interesting, because despite all these things that have been done, and despite all these spikes, it has continued to steadily decline if you look at the graph.
So what we see happening in the United States is a growing division between the supporters of Bush and the people who are against him. We've seen in August a revitalized anti-war movement beginning to form around Cindy Sheehan and her quest to get a second meeting with the president. So you have to wonder what's going to happen as the American population gets divided and the positions get more and more polarized.
The interesting thing about this Cindy Sheehan story is that a lot of commentators have been making the point that or questioning why Bush didn't simply go out and meet her, why he didn't just, you know, drive down there in his pickup, you know, go for a little drive or take her back to the ranch or whatever, and have a 20-minute conversation with her, because this would have essentially constituted a real coup for him. You know what I mean? It would have silenced all of his critics, but they have allowed her. And when we say, we're not saying Bush really here, because certainly Bush doesn't make these policies, but Rove, Bush's brain, as he is called, and the other policymakers seem to have a serious problem with actually just Bush speaking to this woman, which, on the surface anyway, would seem to have been the best thing that they could have done, but it seems that they simply can't bring themselves to actually to do this, because probably in their minds it would be some kind of an admission of guilt, and they're maybe choosing the lesser of two evils in this situation.
There's speculation on the internet that Bush is medicated, that he's been put on antidepressants. They talk about his erratic behavior. He goes out of control and he starts screaming at his subordinates and swearing at them. So it's hard to know whether these are really true, but it would certainly fit the personality profile of a reformed dry drunk who...
Well, that's kind of shocking then, because, you know, what that suggests is that Bush, that his policymakers and the people who really pull his strings and tell him what to say can't actually trust him to simply speak to this woman and say the right things on his own.
Yeah, that would make sense, that he's a loose cannon, and so they have to keep him sequestered on the farm or on the ranch, or they have to keep him in front of especially selected audiences where no one will say anything hostile to him, which brings up the recent speech he did before the Veterans of Foreign War, where there were photos that were circulating of vets wearing cardboard covers over their ears that said bullshit deflectors on them. And apparently Bush was absolutely irate about this and has told the VFW that he will not ever go back and speak to any of them unless they're able to control their members. And it's all about control.
Yeah, so we can kind of almost empathize with the problem that these backroom boys in the U.S. government have to deal with this president that they have, to try and present him as a competent and a coherent president that, as many Americans expect him, the commander in chief, the leader of the nation, the guy who has the hotline and takes all the decisions. When he is,
he's believing the script.
Yeah, but he's utterly incompetent. So what do they do? I mean, they have to really, they're walking really kind of fine line there between continuing with this charade of him as a coherent president, and but at the same time not pushing it so far that they end up exposing him for the cretin that he really is.
So he could end up being the wild card that brings down the entire structure,
or exposes the man behind the curtain.
Exposes the man behind the curtain, yeah. And if the man behind the curtain get exposed, then the best laid plans of mice and conspirators get brought to light. And one thing, when you look over what's going on and the similarities with the month before 9/11, is it really looks as if the scenario is planned. It appears that there's a multi-stepped scenario to bring the United States to the boiling point and have the two sides confronting one another, so that martial law can be declared, so that a fascist state can be more openly implemented. In thinking about this, some of the steps that we've noticed, you know, it appears to have begun back in the 80s under the Reagan administration, where you had many of the same people in power. Of course, George W.'s father was the vice president. Cheney had an important role. Rumsfeld had an important role in the Reagan administration. And it was back then, at the same time as we were hearing about the Russians and sort of the Soviet Union as the evil empire, that we were also hearing about terrorism. The emphasis on terrorism was being very pronounced for the first time. So establishing terrorism as the main enemy seems to have been the policy brought down back in 20 years ago. After that, we get the events of 9/11, which were like an electroshock to the American public, to galvanize the population into a completely irrational hatred of Muslims and Arabs and other people from the Middle East, Central Asia, Asia. And we've seen in the last few years how that's gone. After that, the continued emphasis on the great threat to the continental U.S. itself from these people, which is so outlandish that it's hard to imagine it's been as successful as it's been.
Yeah, I mean, that idea really goes to the heart of the matter, because really what we're talking about here is the entire terrorist threat that has been promulgated in the news for the past six, seven, eight, nine years. We're talking about going back to the original World Trade Center bombing in 93, and then after that various embassy bombings and the bombing of the USS Cole, all supposedly done by Al-Qaeda, by this Arab or Muslim terror threat. We really need to get back to the beginning here and ask the question as to whether this terror threat is actually real or not. I mean, what are its foundations? Is there any rationale or is there any logic that would support the idea of a terror threat as it's being presented, or of an Arab terror threat or a Muslim terror threat as it's being presented by the American government, the British government, the Israeli government?
It's hard to imagine when you see that the defense budget of the United States is larger than the next 10 or 12 countries combined. It is so unimaginably large that it's hard to imagine anyone being able to successfully conquer the United States.
Yeah, I mean, one way to actually try and assess whether there's any truth behind this terror threat, or as it's being promoted, the Islamic terror threat, is to look at other so-called terrorist organizations, and by this we mean real terrorist in quote organizations that have existed over the past few decades, you know.
I mean, like the CIA and.
No, not. Yeah, I mean, not real in those terms. They're the real ones, but I mean, let's call them freedom fighters then, for want of a better word, because that would probably fit better with our definition of them. But what we notice about such groups that have existed is that not one of them have ever, in the history of their activities, have ever been able to carry out an attack of the complexity of 9/11. I mean, I kind of defy anyone to show evidence or cite me an example of any terrorist or freedom fighters grassroots organization that has sprung up in the past 100 years that was able to orchestrate and carry out an attack within all the complexity that 9/11 involved on a nation like the US or any other major nation state. There simply hasn't been any. So that's the first point to be considered in terms of looking at the reality or otherwise of Al-Qaeda or the terror threat, the Islamic terror threat. The other thing we notice about these real bona fide terrorist or freedom fighter groups is that they all enjoyed or they all sprang up from a grassroots level in terms of the fact that they had sometimes very wide popular support among the population of the country from which they operated, or indeed from other countries around the world.
Yeah, we're being told that in Iraq, U.S. forces are fighting terrorists, but we'd like our American listeners to sit down and imagine how they would feel if Saddam had actually invaded the United States, or whether it was China, or whether it was any other country. If there were foreign troops on your soil, what would you do? And if you were fighting for your families and your homes and your way of life, would you be a freedom fighter fighting for your own freedoms, or would you be a terrorist fighting against supposedly democracy and liberty that was being imposed upon you by a massive army from overseas? It seems kind of simple. You'd think that this would be something that anybody would be able to grasp. But the brainwashing of the American public through films, through TV, through their whole educational system is such that for many Americans, they're incapable of imagining that their country could do anything wrong.
At this stage, there have been three terror attacks that have defined the Islamic terror threat as posed by, or as we are told is posed by Al-Qaeda. And they are obviously 9/11, the Madrid bombing in March of 2004, and the London bombings in July of 2005. The one common factor among those three attacks were that these Islamic terrorists attacked and killed innocent, mainly innocent, civilians who arguably had nothing to do with the governments or the policies of their governments. So the question has to be asked, why what is the rationale, or why would Al-Qaeda seek to attack ordinary people or the ordinary population of these countries? Because this idea of attacking ordinary people is completely incompatible with what we know of real freedom fighters or real terror groups that have existed over the decades. Because these people, almost by their these organizations, almost by their very definition, were aware of the nature of nation states, because generally they were fighting against some kind of oppression by the nation states in which they lived or in which they were formed. So they understood very well that that these nation states and the people that populated them and the military that supported them cared very little for the ordinary people. So the idea of any of these organizations going and killing ordinary people in any country that they had a problem with certainly wouldn't, they would have understood this, and they did understand that this would not have furthered their aims or furthered their goals in any way. So these groups understood that ordinary people were not the enemy. And they certainly also understood that by attacking and killing ordinary people in these countries, that they were to a large extent shooting themselves in the foot, because this was not a way certainly to bring the public's attention to the oppression that they were fighting against. That is not to say that ordinary civilians were not, or innocent civilians were not killed in these conflicts, but by and large,
they weren't the main target.
Well, not even that, but certainly they weren't the main target. But whenever there were kind of atrocities where innocent civilians were killed, it was generally because the government itself that these groups were fighting against had organized some kind of a counter-terrorist organization or a paramilitary organization to essentially to fight against these freedom fighters or these terrorists. Obviously, this was done in a covert way, and their agenda was to essentially distract the attention, or to certainly distract the point and distract the public's attention from the real goals of these freedom fighters, and to muddy the water and to involve them in a conflict that was essentially unwinnable, or an ethnic conflict or a civil conflict, which took the attention away from the government themselves. So basically what we're saying here is that Al-Qaeda has, because of their actions and by the nature of their actions in killing innocent civilians, have shown themselves to be of a different nature than those groups that we know to be real freedom fighters. Of course, this then brings up the argument, or it can be responded to, but with the argument that these Islamic terrorists are simply crazy, that they don't really know what they're doing, that they're just complete.
They're somehow less than human, and they're willing to take innocent lives because they don't value human life.
Yeah, that their battle is against human life, and we've heard that from the Bush government recently, where they talk about that it's not a war on terror anymore, it's a war on civilization and freedom-loving people, and almost like it's a war that these Islamic terrorists are fighting a war against humanity, that they want to kill everybody, you know what I mean? Freedom, they want to try and destroy a concept of freedom.
Well, at that point, it gets into a completely irrational demonization, which we know has been going on for many years, of the enemy.
But even at that, because some people would certainly suggest that that is the case, that these people are just completely crazy and that there's no way to budget, there's no way to deal with them, there's no way to budget for their actions, or to find a way to resolve the conflict. But that idea that these Islamic terrorists are completely crazy stands in stark contrast to the obvious lucidity and intelligence which they employ in carrying out the attacks that they carry out. Because you would think that if someone was just completely off the wall crazy and wanted to destroy freedom, such like had this idea that they could actually, you know, wipe out freedom, which is such a ridiculous notion, that they would never be able to carry out any kind of an attack or a successful attack against, certainly not against the apparatus or the intelligence and military apparatus of a nation state like America or the UK or even Spain.
Which brings up a second point of what is kind of a signature of these major Al-Qaeda operations, so-called Al-Qaeda operations, 9/11, Madrid and London, which is the simultaneous bombing of several places. And we'll return to this idea later on when we discuss the final point of this plan that we're talking about, that we see being fulfilled. Getting back to that plan, the second point was to make the population believe that there was an immediate threat to the continental United States make Americans think that there were sleeper terrorist cells in every city, make Americans think that anyone could be a potential terrorist. Once that's done, of course, you'll then have the lucid people who are able to look at this and say, well, this is completely crazy. They'll remember that this was the same strategy that was used against communism back in the 50s and 60s when we were told that there were communists under everybody's bed. And so to counter that, there has to be a campaign against these lucid thinking people. Then they are portrayed as lackeys and patsies of the enemy. They will be portrayed as do-gooders who don't really understand the real world and that the enemy will stop at nothing to conquer us. And the argument then goes that because this is the way the real world works, this is the way we ourselves have to operate. We have to, on some level, descend to these kind of tactics ourselves in order to protect ourselves. We see this campaign in the rhetoric of the right-wing pundits who talk about how dissenters are aiding and abetting the enemy. This is some of the rhetoric that's being directed now against Cindy Sheehan, and this is building up. But now it appears that the rhetoric is passing over into action. An example of this is the article that we ran on Friday, August 26th, about a California couple that had been harassed because John Loftus, who has a show on Fox News, gave out the address of somebody that he thinks is a terrorist. First thing is, this is an incitement to vigilante action. If there is, in fact, a terrorist, it's the police who are going to deal with it. It's not the citizenry who shall go out like a Frankenstein movie with their pitchforks and their flaming torches to chase the monster terrorist up to the mill on the top of the hill. There are legal facilities, legal procedures in place to deal with this, and it is for those legal, if we want to live in within the rule of law, it is for these forces to go and deal with it. But the problem was the so-called terrorist, who the FBI says is not suspected of any terrorist acts, but the guy who is being accused of all of this had left the house 3 years before, and it's an innocent family who is living in this house who are now being subjected to the taunts, insults, and harassment of their neighbors to the point where a police car has to be stationed in front of their house 24 hours a day. One of the things that was done was that somebody spray painted the word terrorist on their house, only they spelled it terrorist, T-E-R-R-I-S-T. So we're looking at kind of the intellectual level of the kind of people that this rhetoric and propaganda appeals to. They're people that can't even spell. And if there's a word that they should be able to spell, after all the times it has been drummed into their minds for the last 4 years, you'd think it'd be the word terrorist. The next stage in what we see as this planned stepping up of the pressure, because with all of this, you see that there's pressure going on. You're getting the American population polarized. They're working on anger. The people who are against Bush are frustrated because he is not listening. They know he will not listen, and they know that there is very little that they can do other than take to the streets and to call him on his lies. The people who are supporting Bush are more and more moving inward into their little fantasy world of the Arab terrorists getting off and blowing up their local McDonald's. So there's this pressure that is being increased on the American population.
But it's interesting because that really what we're seeing in those procedures is the playing out of some very standard operating procedures or practices that governments have resorted to many, many times over the decades. Getting back to what I was saying about real freedom fighters, real terrorist in quote groups. The policy of governments to counteract that threat, because just to repeat that these groups generally had a cause that was to a large extent understandable and reasonable, and with which a lot of people could identify, a lot of the ordinary population could identify. Now, that posed, obviously, a very serious threat to the government. So when you've got a government who has done something wrong and is in danger of being exposed for doing something or for committing some crime, and you have then a group that is rising up, whether it be a paramilitary group or just an ordinary citizens group that is dedicated to exposing the crime of the government has to do something. And the best thing that has worked time and time again over the years is for the government to essentially divert attention away from their crimes by fomenting conflict and strife among the population. This is what led governments to decide to actively promote and fund counter-terror, counter-revolutionary groups that would then fight, and they would generally be from the other side of the community, because generally these kind of groups rose up in societies that were divided along ethnic or social or political lines. So the policy of the government was to incite conflict between the various groups in society and thereby divert attention away from themselves, which is what we may be seeing happening in the US with this obvious incitement to violence by the Fox News presenter, where he was encouraging, albeit very subtly and surreptitiously, encouraging those people who are less thinking, shall we say, in the US, or less capable of thinking clearly, to go and attack essentially what was another US citizen. It also plays into the Cindy Sheehan thing and the different camps there, the pro and anti-war camps in the US.
We saw the same thing recently at the American Legion Congress that was held in Honolulu, where during the speech, the national commander of the American Legion said, "The American Legion will stand against anyone in any group that will demoralize our troops or worse, endanger their lives by encouraging terrorists to continue their cowardly attacks against freedom-loving peoples." He went on to say, "It would be tragic if the freedoms our veterans fought so valiantly to protect would be used against their successors today as they battle terrorists bent on our destruction." So what he's saying there is that it would be terrible if the freedoms that previous American soldiers had fought to protect would actually be used to express dissent.
Okay, we have to leave open the possibility, at least, that he is, or he is being inspired by what we have talked about in the past as, what we have named in the past as or what is commonly known as COINTELPRO, where you have government agents who will infiltrate or who will arrive at certain demonstrations and will put up this phony front of an opposition. But the important point is that it's presented as a civilian opposition, as a public opposition. It's not this, that they hide the fact that they're actually government agents and present themselves as ordinary citizens. And again, it just serves the purpose of muddying the waters and fomenting civil strife to distract away from the real enemy here, which is obviously the government.
That's kind of an interesting statement because, I mean, maybe we should write a letter to the White House then, because if all these soldiers died in the past to defend freedom and that, you know, that freedom shouldn't be used to be free, well, then the terrorists have already won, so then we could just stop the war on terror, right?
Well, yeah, but there never has been any logic for anybody who really thinks, like, you know, one level below the surface of any of this that's been said there about the war on terror and about Bush's and other members of his administration's rhetoric about the war on terror and that they're defending freedom. And none of it makes any sense, because we see very clearly that the Bush administration is actually doing what they claim the terrorists are doing, which is they're removing social freedoms. They're clamping down on liberties and freedom of movement, freedom of speech, and all these freedoms that they claim that they are defending, they're actually destroying them.
We'll post the second part of this discussion a little later on in the week, and we'll leave you with another song. This one was sent to us this week by a good friend from Canada. You can feel the Canadian prairies in it. It's called Signs of the Times. It's by Relic.
The world is burning out. These are the signs of the tide. The tides are turning. The world is burning. These are the signs of the tides. The tides are turning.
The world is burning.
These are the signs of the times.